All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuckstables? What the Fuckingham Palace guards? Thank you for suggesting that, that fellow on Twitter. I am Mark Maron. This is my show. This is WTF. I appreciate you guys being here. I'm not real sure what I'm going to say today, but that hasn't stopped me before. I am excited about our guest today, Andre Royo, who was Bubbles on The Wire, lives down the street from me, kind of. He's also on this this new series. It's a dramatic series called Hand of God, and it just got picked up by Amazon, so you can look for that, the new season of that early next year. But I was thrilled. I was thrilled to run into him. I actually ran into Andre at the Independent Spirit Awards, and he's a live wire, man. He's electric. He's full-on New York City. It just reminded me of when I lived in New York and just the kind of characters you meet there. He is it, man. He is wired like that city is wired, and it was pretty amazing to talk to him. His wife's got a restaurant down in Atwater that I'm supposed to go eat at, but I haven't yet, but I will. I will go eat there. I've added some Trippity House shows. I'm going to be doing one next Tuesday. That's October 28th. I'll be doing one November 11th and November 18th. If you guys didn't get to see me or you want to see me again or whatever you want to do, they're $8 shows. They're benefits for the theater. They are workshop shows. And you can go to trippityhouse.org and get tickets for those. They generally sell out, so I would go get them if you want to see me. A lot of people have been coming. And like, well, I'm talking about stress. For some reason, every time before I go to the Trippity House, I somehow get myself into some sort of state, man. And I don't do this with all shows, but I don't want to be one of those guys that thinks I have to be crazy in order to perform. But for some reason, before I go to the Trippity House, their 8 o'clock shows, I will drink about a half a pot of coffee at 7:30. I will get into my car. I will, you know, jam out on like loud music that gets me amped up. And by the time I get to the Trippity House, I'm overamped. I'm aggravated. My heart is clenched like a fist, but open. It's weird. I don't know if you've ever had that feeling where your entire body is tight, but your heart is open. It's almost like, well, I can't close my heart, but my body's ready to snap shut at any moment. And it seems like a lot of my better performances come from me working back from a tremendously stressed out state. And I know people have suggested meditation for me. You know, on Monday, Martin Starr suggested maybe I'd get into Buddhism. But I don't, like, what do you learn? Why quiet it down? Why should I quiet it down? Why people are like, you got to, you know, move through the distractions, get rid of the distractions. Just listen to your breath. Close your eyes. Sit and breathe. But what is the big realization? I mean, usually I don't try to meditate until I'm whacked out of my mind. And then I'm just sitting and breathing and I'm, you know, it's panicky. I'm almost hyperventilating. That's not meditating. But I can definitely feel something when I hyperventilate. I mean, I can feel myself getting dizzy and I'm like, this is really good. That's not meditating. That's panic. I guess I'm just copping to the fact that, you know, I need to electrify my mind in order for it to fire on all cylinders and get my imagination going. Because last night was a spectacular show. But here's something that I've recently become aware of, and I just want to give some of you people a heads up. And you know if I'm talking to you or not, and if I'm not talking to you, whatever, listen or don't. Figure out whether or not you're addicted to sadness. Figure out whether or not you're addicted to tragedy. Figure out whether or not you're addicted to maintaining a victim's disposition. I guess what I'm saying is I talked to my father, and, you know, we're talking and everything's fine. But, you know, I literally have to talk him out of some sort of pit of despair whenever I talk to him, which is okay. But I have to fortify myself before I call him, because it's at this point, you know, with your parents, it's weird because I know that I'll call my father and he'll go, hello. And I'll go, hello. And he'll go like, you don't sound good. What's up? I'm like, what are you judging on? It was a greeting. I'm not taking the bait. But we had a nice conversation, but then I realized that sadness is compelling and self-pity is compelling because it's consistent. You know, it's weird. Happiness is fleeting. Positivity takes a lot of energy if it's not your natural disposition, which it isn't for most people. And you can be one of those people if you want. But the idea, that weird, warm heat that sort of deep heat of defeat is something consistent. It's deep down in you. Because we know that's what you get from meditation. It's not defeatedness, but it's the awareness that this is all temporary. But the truth of the matter is there's nothing more consistent and easily tapped into than that feeling of sadness. And you know, one of the symptoms of this is like how much you, like my father, we have a big long conversation about how I'm doing. I'm saying I'm great. He says he's okay. And then like, I guess it was going too well because he goes, oh God, man, you know, I was about to hang up. And he's like, yeah, the world is, it's ending. It's ending. The world's ending, you know, ISIS and global warming. And like, it's just this litany, this list of things. And I'm like, why are you doing that to yourself? You're not an ISIS target necessarily. I know you think the world of yourself, but that's not it. But what I realized in that moment is that there's a, you know, for a lot of people, sadness, tragedy, paranoia, and the pain of defeat is steady. It's right there under the surface at all times on an existential level. So it's the easiest thing to tap into. And I would say if you could, and this is just me giving you a heads up because I'm giving myself a heads up. It's not, I don't want you to be apathetic and I don't want you to avoid things, but try to put things in perspective and decide what is really within your control, what you can do something about, and what you're getting out of that sadness. What are you getting out of it? I mean, it does separate you from the pack because you're the buzzkill guy. You know, and you don't want to be that guy, or you're the guy that's sort of like, oh, everyone's got to struggle to be around you. Because you're inconsolable. Inconsolable over what? What's your problem? I'm inconsolable over being alive. Because if you have that disposition, no one's going to make you feel better, right? So what is your agenda in life? To drag other people down to your level, and that's when you feel better. When you finally get somebody to go like, oh my God, yeah, it does suck. And you're like, right? Okay, I'll see you later. Jesus Christ, try to avoid that. Would you? I'm trying. You try. I hope I didn't do it to you during this monologue. I really do. If I did, I'm sorry. All right, man. Are you ready to talk? Are you ready to talk to the man behind Bubbles on the Wire? That is one of the best characters ever on television ever. So strap in, man. This Andre Royo guy can he's electric, man. All right, let's talk to Andre. Andre Royo.
Yeah.
I would think that if it's Spanish, but no.
Yes, it's a sore spot.
On my
whole Cuban side of my life. It's a sore spot that I can't speak Spanish. I can't roll my R's. Yeah, I can't do that.
And you got an R issue?
I have an R issue, yes.
What's your R issue?
I can't roll it. I got a fat tongue.
Oh, so it's just...
Ladies, I have a fat tongue.
Yeah. Put it out there,
you know.
So you just, like to me, you're a personification of New York City.
Yes, I am a personification of New York City. Is that the acting or the voice?
Just you.
Just my embodiment.
Like when I ran into you at the Independent Spirit Awards, yeah. Like it was just sort of like, what? New York's wandering around.
Yes, I was.
Take care of New York.
Yeah, somebody make sure he has a pass. Because you know New York. He's walking around and going into the Jameson tent. There's a problem.
But you moved to, you live down the street from me.
I do. I live in Highland Park right next to this big ass... I think high school.
Why the fuck would you move? Then you got to deal with the bells.
You know what? I got hypnotized in South Pasadena, where everything was about the farmer's market every Thursday, and I was like, yo, I'm not ready. I'm not ready to punch in my clock and say, okay, I'm done.
Yeah.
I just want a rocking chair and fresh organic oranges. I wasn't ready.
Well, it's not. It's a little bit of a sort of a quiet middle class life in Pasadena.
I mean, it's beautiful.
You need some grit.
I need a little bit of New York grit. And somebody told me, yo, let's go have a drink at Johnny's.
Yeah.
And I was like,
oh, sure.
Johnny's, that sounds kind of weird. Yeah, let's go to Johnny's.
Right.
It reminds me of the Low East Side a little bit.
It does, right? Yo, that chunk of York, I never really thought about it. because it just started happening.
Yes. That's what I heard.
But I lived on the Lower East Side. But if I really thought about it, those two blocks, you know, the one with the coffee shop, Johnny's, and it's a little Lower East Side.
Very little. But if you go back to New York, there is no Lower East Side. So this is what I got left.
Gone.
Yeah, it's gone. I think that's another part of the world. Another part of my memory that it's fucked up.
But the weird thing is when people compare stuff to New York, even when they compare it to like it's like New York, it's not. Because even if it's a block, you know, maybe the block looks like that, but you feel the weight.
Yes.
And the energy in New York. Yes. Where'd you grow up exactly?
I grew up in the Bronx in Bostonville, Fifth Avenue. But most of my growing up, as far as into manhood, was probably Lower East Side, you know.
Really?
A and B, C and D.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy.
How old are you?
Now I'm 45.
You're 45. I'm 50.
Yeah. Well, you look good, because white people age different. So you look good for 50. I don't know what you're doing. It must be the 5 months hit it and quit it, because you look good for 50. Because I went back to my high school reunion, and 50 fucks white people up. They look like they just melting. They just look like it's all melting into their belly.
Something gave up.
Yes. Yeah, so you look good for 50. Congratulations.
But like, I have questions about that type of that area, because I lived on second between A and B.
Yep.
1989 to 1991.
Okay.
So I
wasn't there yet.
You weren't there yet?
I wasn't there yet. I graduated in 86, and I thought, you know, I had brainwashed my family into believing that I would do good in school if I left all this distraction of New York City. So I went to school in Florida, where it was bikinis and fucking just even more of a mess, in West Palm Beach, where a black man got the real experience of spring break. And so I got a 0.73 average and had to get the fuck out of there.
0.73,
that wasn't good. It was
that's
just
commendably bad.
Yes. I was all in. I was all committed to the bikinis.
But we're like in the Bronx, so like, you know, paint me a picture of that. I mean, what was your family like? You got a bunch of brothers and sisters?
No, only child.
Only child.
Only child. Only child, and it was a very interesting experience that I can reflect on and realize, wow, I kind of stood out without knowing it, because my mom and dad were together, and we lived in a little two-story private house in the Bronx next to the Hillside Projects, and I realized that I felt, you know, regular, but I was looked upon as kind of rich.
Oh, really?
Because everybody's living, house, and everybody's living in the projects, and mom and dad were together. All of my friends were either living with their dad or living with their mom or being raised by their grandparents.
Yeah.
So I would come home from school and half the neighborhood would be in my house just looking at my mom and dad like, this is the leave it to Cleaver. This is it. Look at how this motherfucker's living. And it kind of helped me because, you know, when I would try to get, you know, I'm a little nerdy dude, you know, glasses, braces.
Are you really? Around. You were a nerd?
I was a nerdy dude, but they kind of looked out for me in the neighborhood because they saw me living with my mom and dad. When I tried to get into dirt, they were like, "Nah, man, get the fuck off the block. Go home to your mama. You're going to private school. Yeah. We're gonna make sure you make it.
Let us sell these drugs. We don't need your help.
We got you." Yeah. When my mom came down the street, they would hide the drugs. Like, "Hi, Mrs. Royo. How you know, Mrs. Royo?" Or they call her Mama Drugs, because really, if somebody, a young cat, was like selling drugs when my mom walked down the block, they fuck them up. Like, you didn't see her walking? That's Mama Drugs.
Yeah.
Don't sell, because they like to hang out at the house.
Oh, right.
So they didn't want that bad, you know, they didn't want that bad.
They like the family atmosphere, and they didn't want to fuck that up.
They didn't want to fuck that
dealing.
Up, yes.
But, so what'd your dad do?
My dad had a couple of clothing stores in Harlem, Mr. T's, Ebony Fashion. So he was like an entrepreneur, and he would come home and bring... I mean, talk about a nerdy kid looking like Little Caesar.
Yeah.
I had the floor shine wingtips. I had the double breasted suits. I had
And the glasses,
you know, and I was like, hey, guys, come on. I had the Pierre Cardin, like, you know, ties, matching handkerchiefs. So I would go to school, and the teachers used to be a little jealous. Like, you dress better than we do.
Your dad took care of you.
He took care of me.
And what did your mom do?
My mom, at that time, she was working at Albert Einstein. She was an accountant. Working in the building side. You know, I don't really know what she did. I just know that she was home by 6. I was a latchkey, so I would come home and just let myself in. So from 3 to 6, I was home by myself.
Yeah.
And that was like another thing that the neighborhood loved, because my house was empty.
They watched TV.
I had the short stay hotel in my house. I used to charge people to go in the room, bang it out a little bit, and leave me some money. So I used to cook them Steak-Em sandwiches. Remember Steak-Em sandwiches?
Sure. Steak-Ems.
I used to cook them Steak-Em sandwiches.
It's like
a little
Philly cheesesteak.
That's right.
Yeah.
I used to cook that, and when they came out the room, I would feed them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
These are your buddies, though.
It was my short stay. A little bit of money, and it was a hotel.
Oh, that's sweet. But
it's sweet. Thank you.
So which side's Cuban?
I'm a father.
Your father's Cuban?
Mm-hmm.
And how now? How far have you? How many generations are in the States?
His parents were in Cuba.
Really?
So he was born here.
I never talked to somebody with a Cuban background.
Talking to one now because I don't know anything about it. I had a choice between Menudo and New Edition when I was growing up, and I went New Edition. So you're not talking to one now. But
trips back to Cuba.
One trip when I was four, I don't remember any of it at all.
You still got people there or no?
I believe so. My father just went back maybe about a couple of years ago and was looking for some relatives. I think he found some in the hills somewhere. But it was just different. It was a different experience. Like, I would love to go back now before they turn it into Disneyland. But
that's the fear. Like, people want to go back to
they want to go now before
the decrepit charm of lack of maintenance.
That's right. They don't want to see McDonald's there. Yeah, they don't want to see IHOP.
Yeah,
you know. But you know, it was just weird. I don't speak Spanish. I don't dance. My father was apparently a famous dancer.
Really? Apparently,
when I hung out with him and we would go to like nightclubs when I was at that age.
Yeah.
You know, they would slap me in the back of the head like, your father used to dance with 3-4 women, blah, 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 blah. He could dance his ass off. And I had to wait for the little hip hop section to come on. And then I'd dance. And they would look at my father like, what the fuck did you do?
Why didn't you how come you didn't train the kid?
Yes, that's right.
You didn't teach him anything?
Nothing. Speaking Spanish, it was hard because, you know, Mom ran the household.
Oh, she did?
My dad was the enforcer, but my mom was like, you know, taking care of everything, so English was more prominent.
Right.
So, you know, and then I, you know, go outside.
Did your mom speak Spanish?
Only cállate la boca. You know, cállate, shut the fuck up or go give me some dinero.
Oh, so he, your father just got trained.
He got trained. That's right. I'm sorry, Dad.
You can have the woman, but she's not going to speak your language. Yeah, yes, so get up to speed.
Yes. My father wanted to name me Carlos, and that didn't work out. But that's good, because Carlos Royo, that can't speak Spanish, that would have been devastating.
That's a lot of pressure.
Yes. But I think I'm going to take it now. I think I made a pledge to my dad.
Good luck with that.
Is it harder, you think?
I have no aptitude for it. I mean, if you got a feel for it, then maybe you'll
be all
right.
How do you know? Have you tried speaking a different language?
I'm shitty with grammar and English.
Yeah, I'm still working on English, too.
Yeah, because like a lot of
it's the enunciation that I have a problem with.
But it's like a lot of it is, you know, tenses.
Yeah.
So like everything changes. Like, I think if you have a fundamental understanding of grammar and you kind of have a handle on language, and I mean, maybe you can do it. I don't know that I really tried. It just seemed like
I just got back from Berlin, right? It's my first time.
What were you doing there?
I was working on this project. This director wanted to do a TV show and he wanted to shoot a teaser. And just hanging out in Berlin. Well, I guess, you know, you experience it if you travel abroad a lot, but everybody speaks like three languages, four languages. America, we just like this. What? Yeah. Well, English is all we needed, so fuck off.
And we'll wait for someone to speak English. Yeah. Like, no, I can't. When are you going to?
Yeah, you fix it. You change it. So I feel a little, you know, as I get older, I know I'm about to kick the bucket soon, and I just feel like it's ignorant that we did not explore and learn like at least two to three languages.
Well, I think it's a little, I think it is sort of ignorant, but it also has to do with the public school system. What are you going to do? I think that by nature of the intimacy of Europe, and these people are traveling from country to country,
they
probably have friends in other countries, and sometimes the languages are not that different.
That's right.
They kind of, like, they just pick it up.
They embrace it, yeah.
They don't think about it. Here, it's like...
Well, you know, like I say, we're in L.A. We're traveling, really. Two blocks is all Mexican.
I know.
So we can do it, too, but we just like, fuck you, speak English.
It gets late in the game.
Is it harder than...
I don't know. Try it, man. Well, you can get the Rosetta Stone shit.
I got the Rosetta Stone. Then I'm going to pay the $3,000 to do Berlitz or whatever that...
You are?
I'm going to do it. Because at least I got to look at my dad like, hey, I gave it the effort. So if I don't speak it now, I can at least say, Dad, I tried.
Well, even if you know, you learn some things.
Yeah.
Even if you don't know it conversationally.
I'm
going to
say his eulogy will be in Spanish.
Yeah.
I'll give him that. I'll give him his wings and speak
badly
eulogy.
Pronounced Spanish. Yeah. You're going to go out of your way to stumble.
Spanglish.
A Spanish eulogy.
Yes.
I like this idea that you're a nerdy kid and you're looked at as a little higher than the rest of them, but they're not beating up on you because of that.
No.
Because they like your parents.
They like my parents. They like me walking around with your floor shine and double-breasted suits. They were like, yo, you're straight out of our fucking TV. What are you? I'm, you know.
Your character.
I was a character, and they really kind of protected me.
What does that mean? Like, what you mean you just want to go along with some shit?
I wanted to hang out all night in the corner and like drink a 40, mix it with the fucking pina colada bottles and James. They're like, no, drink water. No, go to the store, get us some Sundews and get us a bag of chips and then take your ass home.
We got a lot of hope on you, kid.
Yeah. It's all riding on you.
KRS-One
and Andre Royal. Let's go.
We only get one of those every once in a while.
That's right.
We voted you the guy.
It was amazing. And like, even you know.
What kind of shit was going on, really, right there?
From my point of view growing up, it was just regular kid stuff. You know, right. A couple of shootings, a couple of gang bangers, you know. One girl was burning everybody in the neighborhood. They made sure I didn't sleep with her. Like, she was hot. I was like the first double D's I ever saw in my life. I'm like this. I want her. And they would pull me over like, you stick your dick in her and it'll explode. We're not allowing
some
you.
Some burning means you're giving everybody the clap.
STD, clap, the syphilis, all of it. She had all of it. Like, she had everything. But it wouldn't stop nobody because you get really fucked up enough. You're like, I'll try.
Maybe that's how it happens.
Maybe it'll skip me.
Yeah. Maybe
if I go anal, it won't affect me. That's how we thought we were young.
That's a pretty logical, I guess. Well, everybody thinks they're going to be the ones that can avoid it. Like, yes. Not everybody gets it.
Yeah, somebody has to be clean.
Yeah. Somebody's going to get lucky.
Yeah, and we had somebody's mom who was a nurse, so she used to have the penicillin pills. So
is that true?
Yeah, we had somebody's mom was a nurse, and we would just go there and get like, can I get some penicillin pills?
Is that true?
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So everybody, like,
we were thinkers. It was corporate America in the hood. We knew how to fucking solve problems.
So you're a pretty good student in high school, though, right?
No.
No.
No, because no. I just took everything, you know, I took everything for granted.
Yeah.
Again, I went to an all-boys school. My mom and dad did whatever they had to do and got me into the school, Mount St. Michael Academy.
Yeah.
And they took me on like a Sunday.
Yeah.
And I walked in. I'm looking at this campus, 3 football fields, 2 baseball fields. It looked like a castle.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, my God, this is amazing. I signed up. The principal was like, yo, you ain't got the grades, but your parents love you, and you got the look, you fucking nerd. What's wrong with you? You look like you could be Bill Gates, or he wasn't around, but you look like you could be this, a small kid. And I went there on a Monday trying to save a seat for a girl, and found out it was all boys, and lost my mind.
You didn't know?
I didn't know. They took me on a Sunday, and they wanted to sell the image.
That was a deal breaker.
It was a deal breaker as far as, okay, now it's my turn to pay back. I'm not doing nothing. I'm not.
Did you have to wear an outfit?
No, we just had to wear, it was picture perfect for me because there was no uniform, but you just had to wear a suit. Mm-hmm. Like a tie.
You had suits.
I had suits for days. I told you. The teachers was like, who is this walking in looking like the dean? Who is this little motherfucker? And I was doing good until certain things needed effort. Like, I was good in math until it became algebra, and then I didn't know why they had letters and numbers.
I have no idea.
Like, I don't know why you told me one's alphabet, one's numbers. Why are you mixing them?
Yeah.
1A plus 1B means somebody dropped the Scrabble board, and I don't know what's going on. And I didn't, and this is, I guess, a part of where I'm growing up and my friends, I did not see what being good in school was really going to evidently bring
right
to me.
Yeah.
Everybody was doing, you know, construction, working, starting their own business.
Yeah.
Going to the army or selling drugs.
Yeah.
So there's nobody there that was like, you know, I graduated a magnum cum laude.
Right.
You know, everybody was like, go to school. That's, you know, 3 hours of you to do something else.
But college was necessarily, but that's usually the thing you're thinking is like, college, you're going to go to college.
Well, you go, you know, when you start high school, about the 10th, 11th, 12th grade, that's when they hit you up with the, where are you going to go?
Yeah,
where are you going to go?
Yeah.
Are you ready? Are you prepared? You want to do it? And I'm like, no, I want to be an actor. And when you say acting, they don't question how to do it. They just say, you sure?
Yeah.
You know, that's a hard one. That's crazy talk, right? No. You're not going to make it. And that just motivated me. Like,
when did you decide you wanted to be an actor?
I decided, like, I would say probably around 12th grade, 11th, 12th grade, I decided I wanted to be an actor, but didn't know what that meant.
Right.
Like, I didn't know.
Everybody wants to be an actor at some point.
I mean, I didn't know how to get there.
Yeah.
And college wasn't an ideal aspect. That was where you had to study.
Yeah.
But acting is fun. It's playtime. So I would hang out in like Manhattan and just try to be discovered. Like walking around up and down fucking Soho with a suit on. Like, come on. I heard about it. I go to Ice Cream Parlor. Come on. I know. I heard the stories. You fine, motherfucker. So find me. And it didn't happen.
When did you go down the Lower East Side? When were you living there? So you went to college.
I went to college for 2 years.
Florida, what for?
West Palm Beach, Florida.
What was the school?
It was a school called Northwood Institute.
And your parents were just sort of like, we're going to get you in somewhere.
They paid the money. They bought the shit I was selling and said that if I go there, it was an automotive dealership school.
Right? What?
It was an automotive dealership school.
How the fuck did you land on that?
Because it was the only school that first took me. and second, they had a quota. They was like, you know, we need like, I was like 7 black people and I was one of 7.
For auto dealership school?
I mean, that was their main thing. I took business. I took advertising. But their main crux of the school was automotive, was big dealerships teaching their kids how to take over the business. So I'm hanging out with kids that have Testarossa. What was that car called? The Testarossa?
Oh, yeah, Testarossa.
Testarossa,
yeah.
The Porsche. They'll be at all these dealerships. So every kid.
I've never heard of this. I never heard of a school that focus was car dealership.
Yeah, that's what it was. And I was the honor student for a little while because that one teacher teaching business was like, you know what, you dress really sharp.
And you get high marks.
That was high marks. Just appearance sells. Yeah. Look the part, be the part, motherfucker. Like, you know.
They thought you meant it.
They thought I
showed up
serious.
With your suits. Yeah. You're like, this guy is going to be good.
He's going to be big.
Nah, he's quota and he's good.
Yes. But then they didn't tell me that the girls would go to school with bikinis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, getting ready to go to, you know, the beach and all that. And that tore me up. That tore me up because then also the girls were like looking at me, and I had a buddy of mine that I convinced to go with me, and they were looking at us like, you know, is it true? Like, is it true what they say about, well, come on, let me talk to you about it. Or, I hate my dad. You know what would piss him off? Yeah. I do know what would piss him off.
I'm willing to be available.
I'll take
that.
Care of that revenge. And that was, you know, that really, really.
I had a great time.
It destroyed my, you know, collegiate adventure.
But you helped a lot of girls.
I helped a lot of girls, and it taught me. It prepared me. Now that I think about it, it prepared me when I came back.
Yeah.
When I went to Soho, when I finally started hanging out in the Soho area, I wasn't blown away by, you know, how different the race was, and the whites was, you know, accepting blacks and money and all.
But New York never really felt that way to me. You felt that?
I mean, well, yeah, in the hood, yeah. In the hood, you know, I would go to Arlington Avenue and get chased by some Italians, like, get the fuck out of here, monkey. Like,
right.
You would feel it.
Right.
But it was just growing up.
Right.
It wasn't like, oh my God, it was like, doesn't everybody go through this?
Yeah,
like,
you know,
it didn't stand out as wrong.
Right.
It stood out as, you know what neighborhood to go to, you know what not to. And you go in that neighborhood, then you're wrong.
Right.
They're not wrong. You're the asshole for going in there.
But Soho's sort of like a walkthrough neighborhood.
Soho was just, it's about money.
Yeah.
We don't care what race you are, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Why are you standing out? And you're here for a reason.
And if you look good, that means something.
That means that, you know, you get a pass.
You come back from Florida.
Let's say 91, because I came back, I was doing construction with my dad, and he was, you know.
What happened to the clothing store?
At one point, it was over. You know,
it's gone.
It's just gone. And he started doing construction, which was bigger money. I mean, I was making $22 an hour.
Well, he was contracting?
He was doing laboring, you know, laborer. I was local 6A cement laborer, and it was great. Like 22.
So he was a union guy?
Union guy. Yep.
Wow, that's a big shift from entrepreneur to cement guy.
New York City, baby. You know how it is, New York City. You can make it happen. You bump into jobs. You bump into a whole new life.
That's the one thing I've always noticed about New York. At any hour during the day, at any hour, your morning, noon, or night, in the middle of the night, there's always a guy in a hole working on something.
Something needs to get done. Yeah. Something needs to get done.
Something's broken in the guts of the city.
That's right. You don't know.
Yeah.
With the daytime, you know, movies, they don't know how they live.
Yeah.
If we don't do what we do.
I love that about New York, though. Yeah. There's always a dude, you know, like yelling at a guy with that hard hat
on. In the subway?
Yeah.
The subway,
but they're just everywhere.
4 o'clock in the morning, you see that one guy with rats around his fucking.
I've never felt safer anywhere, really. Yeah. I don't, out here, it's scary.
Because there's no isolation.
No, that's right.
It's always people around.
You just walk outside and you're part of it.
Yeah.
So early 90s, you go to the Lower East Side, you got a friend.
I got a friend and his girl is going to an acting school called HB Studios. And I say, can I go with you? And I walk over and we go to the school and I'm looking. And, you know, it's one of those, you know, schools where, you know, everybody got a room and they're taking, you know, they're doing monologues, they're doing classes. And I'm sitting around like, oh, this is where you go, I guess, when you want to get started, instead of me walking up down the block
waiting for somebody to pick me. Did you have pictures or anything?
No, I had no pictures yet. It was just like, you know, I didn't know what to do. I was like, discover me. Let's go. And then, you know, that started. I signed up for class there, and all of a sudden you just surround yourself with that energy. I was doing plays. I was talking to other actors.
But the Lower East Side, like at that time, like Giuliani had already come in, right? So that
he came in. But they had a lot of theaters. They had like off Broadway.
Right, but there was a lot of cops around. Where were you living?
I was living, the first place I lived was third between A and B, right next to the cop station, across the street from Mama's Kitchen.
Not
Mama's Kitchen. It was just a park. Mama's Kitchen was on Fifth.
I loved Mama's Kitchen.
Mama's Kitchen was great. Everything tastes like garlic.
Yeah. But it was like he was like running a catering business in a restaurant.
In a storefront.
And you could go and get all this whole like kind of comfort food
That's right.
I love that place.
The mac and cheese, the string beans, the roasted chicken. It was great. Yeah.
I wonder what happened to that. It didn't stay
open.
It's
an NYU cafeteria now.
It is?
I don't know.
Everything's
NYU bought everything.
But so you were living down there, because I'm just trying to connect my memories, because it was just fucking heroin everywhere when I was
Save the Robots.
I lived right around the corner from that.
I used to live upstairs from Delia's. know, dealing.
Yep.
Yeah, so, you know, and then I would go.
Great neighborhood.
Great neighborhood. I mean, heroin, women.
But they were redoing the park when you were there. Like, cause when
Thompson
I,
Park?
Yeah.
It was, yeah, they were redoing a park, and it was, I just missed that. I just missed
the protest.
That whole big night.
I was
yes.
there for that.
See, yeah.
Yeah, the crazy, the squatters were pissed, the
that's
people
right.
that lived in tents were
enough.
Pissed. Yes. Yeah, and there was a lot of action, yeah. But Giuliani just crushed everything.
We had the squirrels on crack. They used to attack the people. I mean,
crack squirrels.
Crack squirrels was crazy. And all the squatters, I know squatters must be mad now, because I was just thinking about that. Squatting and illegal sublets just turned into Airbnbs.
Yeah.
I mean, they just make a way. Whitey's make a way to make, you know, make money, make it corporate.
Well, I don't recognize that neighborhood anymore, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but certainly all that
it's
grip
different.
It's different because
yeah.
everybody who was sort of like they moved everybody who lived in New York out of New York, and in a weird way, the people that
they didn't move them, they kicked them out.
They kicked them out.
They drew the line. If you cannot afford it,
that's
get
right
out.
But it's sort of sad. That's the yeah. saddest part about it. Is like yeah. you could always see people that, you know, still had rent control apartments and
yeah.
still had, you know, subsidized
gone.
Housing
gone.
That were sort of integral to the way the city felt.
Yeah.
And now it's like it's no one, they're all gone. Where the hell yeah. they live in Staten Island, Brooklyn, wherever?
Well, Brooklyn's getting turned out.
Yeah.
And the Bronx is getting turned out.
Where the hell are the people that run the city going to live?
I think we're eating them. We're eating the people.
Soylent Green.
Soylent
yeah,
Green.
That's right.
I always tell people now, when I'm hanging out and talking, they say, yo, you know, do you miss New York? And I just tell them, I say, I miss New York most when I'm in New York.
Because right.
that New York doesn't exist anymore.
It's weird.
The New York that
right?
we know.
It's weird, right?
It is weird. It's weird, sad. Sad is wrong because I know, you know, the next generation, like my daughter and all that, they're going to experience a New York that we don't know. And I guess our parents said the same thing to us. So, you know, it's
but were
it's
you
different.
Ever? Were you ever a party guy, though?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Nels, The
yeah.
World,
oh,
MKs,
Nels.
Rex.
I had
Nels
one that,
is the best.
It wasn't really my thing.
No, okay.
But, you know, I was never a club guy because I was doing comedy, but I met a dude. I went to Nels once for whatever fucking reason. I don't even know why I went there. I ended up having one of the worst nights of my life, smoking cocaine with some dude I met at Nels
yes.
who said he was in advertising.
Uh-huh.
So I end up at his apartment with these two girls, and he's basing.
Thank God you put the girls in the story because I got nervous for you.
Oh, no, yeah, no. The girls were there, but I didn't. Yeah. He was using me. Like to get, you know, I don't know how I just remember there was something creepy about it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I was still using, so it was
yeah.
crazy. He's like, you think you get those girls to come with us? I'm like, yeah,
yeah. Well,
he's got cocaine.
I'll make you laugh. Yeah, see, what's great about those clubs in New York were, you know, there's so many different experiences.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't have that experience.
Yeah.
But you can see it. Like, I look at you and I'm like this. Well, that motherfucker's fucked up.
Yeah, he's in trouble.
He's about to get turned out. That dude about to get turned out. That dude, he don't know he's talking to a girl right now. He has no idea. He's about to grab some balls right now. Watch this. You know,
yeah.
And everybody had a different experience because just the energy and so many people were there. I guess, you know, our parents had Studio 54.
I guess so.
We had Studio 54. If Studio 54 blew up,
yeah,
it was Nels, The World, MK. It wasn't never just one place. We had so many.
But that was part of your life.
That was part of my life.
Running around.
Then I became a doorman for a club called the Cheetah Club.
I remember that place.
And it was big. That's when hip hop was in the full explosion.
Right.
And black people just had a lot of money. Every hip hop guy had a lot of money. And
yeah.
The Cheetah Club every Mondays.
Where was that?
That was on 21st. Between Broadway and maybe.
So you work in the door every Monday?
I was the guy like this. You can come in. You got to change your clothes. Get out. Your girl can come in. And I used to get.
Your girl can come in.
We'll take care of her. But you, really? You come on. Go.
What was the criterion?
For single guys, if a guy was coming, he had to come with at least three or more girls, or we
yeah.
can't let him in. Or, you know, girls can always come in if they, you know, if they're looking hot, they look
yeah.
sexy. And, you know, the ballers, you know, all the Knick players would come,
yeah.
Puffy and all those guys would come. This was the point, you know,
You let them in.
I let them in. I got beat up a couple of times, you know, because I would let the rap artists in, but the producer or the manager, who I didn't know, who's not recognizable, I'd be like, nah, my man, get the fuck out, you know.
You got beat up?
I got slapped up a couple of times. Well, nothing worse than a 5'2 braces, glasses dude telling you can't come into the club. That's gonna work.
Braces?
I had braces. I had the clear ones when they first started, and so when you drank something it turned yellow, so my teeth was fucked up. But I got my first acting job working at the door.
Now were you already in school?
I was in school. I was doing a couple of plays. I had the energy where people knew me from coming off Broadway, like La Mama's and PS 122.
You did shows there? What were some of the plays you were doing?
Like sketch comedy, all like all what do you call original works, you
by
know?
Who
by all of, you know, the writers, the theater groups. You know, you had that one writer who stayed up all night writing about, you know, chicks with dicks, and you tell a joke. But a girlfriend of mine was dating John Singleton, kind of seeing him. And he was casting a movie called Shaft. And she was like, hey, listen, we're going to come to the club tonight. You know, make a spectacle.
Yeah.
You know, I told him you're an actor, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, all right, cool. So I'm telling everybody at the door, yo, it's closed. There's a party. It's shut down. The fire marshal just came. We can't let nobody in.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Hey, Mr. Singleton, move, people.
Yeah.
Come on in. Come on in. And he was like, oh, thank you so much. My girl tells me that you're an actor. I'm like, yeah, you know, I do my thing. And he was like, yo, I'm doing this movie Shaft. Why don't you come in and audition?
What was that? That was with Samuel Jackson?
Sam Jackson, right. Jeffrey Wright. I mean, Tony Collette. It was a big joint. And I walked in. I got the audition. I auditioned like about two or three times. And John Singleton, you know, he liked what I was doing. I only knew that one Spanish line. So I kept saying, "Cállate la boca, tú eres domina buñeta, coño." And he was like, wow, you speak Spanish. I'm like, yeah, I do. Sure. I do. Whatever you need. Whatever you need, John. Whatever you need, baby.
I learned it.
And so I didn't get the part.
Right.
Didn't get the part. And then I was coming out of a club called Bungalow. Remember Bungalow? Bungalow 8?
Mm-mm.
Bungalow 8 was a club. I came out the club and John Singleton was there and he looked at him kind of weird like, oh, this fucking guy's going to yell at me because he didn't get the part and whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And I go up to him and I'm like, hey, look, I'm not mad I didn't get the part. That's nothing to do with you. I hope the movie does well. That means you'll get another movie.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll work.
Right.
Cool. And he was like this. He's like, well, I like that. Thank you so much. I'm like, cool. And then one day, like about a month later, I get a call, and it's John Singleton saying, yo, my actor dropped out. Come in. It's your part. And I was like, cool. And I went in there, and everybody was mean to me because they didn't know who the fuck I was.
And they've been working with the other guy?
They've been working with the other guy, and apparently Shaft had so many problems. People were dropping out, coming in.
Oh, really?
It was supposed to be a mess. I don't know. But when I got there.
How big of a part was it?
It was decent.
Yeah.
It was enough to get me recognized. It was enough for people to go, hey, look at Tattoo.
Shaft.
Yo, what's up? You know, it was one of those parts. And it was cool, but it was the first time, you know, your mom and dad and all your friends are sitting, all the cats from the neighborhood like, see, we did that.
Yeah.
We got you there, motherfucker.
We made sure
you didn't do any dirt, and look at you now. You're a superstar, you're rich. I'm like, no,
you're rich.
That money's spent.
Give me some money.
I drive a Yaris with no hubcaps. Come on. But it was, you know, that part really cemented that I was going to be committed to going for it. Like, I'm an actor now, a working actor, and I wasn't going to do anything else.
Singleton, he did Boys in the Hood, right?
Yeah.
And then he did, like, that movie, Baby Boy, I fucking love that movie. That was great. It's like, I don't know, no one ever talks about it. I think it's a fucking masterpiece.
Underrated. It was a great, great story, and it was
so beautifully
poignant.
Shot.
Yes,
yeah.
You felt that love relationship between Taraji and Tyrese.
Yeah. I'm astounded by that movie, and I talk about it like, and no one's ever seen it.
No, it didn't. I mean, for some reason, you know, Singleton, after Boys in the Hood, he had a couple of movies that didn't do well. So when Baby Boy came out, it didn't get that. If Baby Boy would have came out right after Boys in the Hood, he probably would have got nominated.
But it was just one of those movies where I could, because I don't know the Black experience, and for me. You know, I don't know what the Black community thought about that movie, but for me, it was like, it seemed to me it'd be a reasonable, you know, representation of a struggle, you know, within that community. And for me, it felt like, you know, I had a window in somehow.
That's right. It was, I mean, y'all had, you know, white people had The Way We Were.
Yeah.
We have Baby Boy. It's the same story. It's a love story.
But were there movies that, you know, you grew up with because of that I wouldn't know? I mean, like within the community that were sort of, you know, standard bearers? Is that a weird question?
No, not a weird question. I just, you know, it's a question that, you know, you need to, like, you need to open up that Jameson and have some smoke right now and be like, you know what it is? You know what really moved me? That Car Wash. Car Wash was that movie, brother. That they were talking about the middle class, the economical struggle, and the never say die attitude that we had to have as we washed your fucking car.
Okay,
yeah,
I get
you
it.
Yeah. And, you know, Sidney Poitier and Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
They were the dudes that really was.
What were those?
Up,
those were great movies.
Uptown Saturday Night. Right. Let's do it again.
Yeah, let's do it again.
You know, they were the one that were really speaking to us that, you know, we can share our experience and make money.
Yeah.
I guess the one movie, I guess, that really stood out, that really kind of shown so closely into what I grew up would probably be Coolie High.
I don't even know that movie.
Coolie High was big. Coolie High. Coolie High.
You kind of remember it. Yeah,
Coolie High was big, and it was that neighborhood of blacks going to school, not really learning nothing, but socially learning everything.
Yeah.
Learning how to be a man.
Right.
You know, you go to school, it wasn't really about the, for us, it wasn't really about the education of the books. It was the education of how you handle yourself.
Right.
Around challenges and around other people. And do you step on somebody who wants to learn? No, you let that motherfucker learn. Tease him a little bit, but let him learn. Like, don't interfere with somebody else's dream.
Right.
Go for yours. And it was Coolie High was probably the number one movie that we all felt.
Right.
Expressed our outcome up.
And also, and again, made you feel like, well, I could do that.
I could do that. Yes. Yeah. That was the one time I didn't know what was going on with me, but I was like, I want to be part of that. The movie, the white movie, that made me say I could do that, or I the power of the cinema was Rocky.
Yeah.
Because we grew up in the Bronx, we had a theater called the Melba Theater, and we would go there in the afternoon, and I remember it was like, four chicken wings, french fries, some pizza, we'd go in there.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And watch Rocky. Yeah. And towards the end of the movie, I was just like, yo, I couldn't believe that the whole theater full of black people was rooting for Rocky.
Yeah.
Come on, beat the fuck out of Apollo Creed. I'm like, why? What happened to us? Why are we rooting for the white guy? And I walked out like, that's movie magic right there. That right there, because Apollo Creed wasn't a bad guy. He wasn't evil.
Yeah.
He was like Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
But we were like, kill him, Rocky. Get him.
That's real magic.
I haven't felt that kind of movie magic in a long ass time.
I like that you brought the food in the theater. I was living in Astoria, and there was a theater around the corner from me. Where, like, the people in the neighborhood, they literally just short of bringing barbecues.
Yo, set up a table. Set up a table. That's they do now. They got that dining theater for $40. I'm like, no
dude,
I go to the Arclight still and bring that goddamn tender greens. I get the tender greens. I go in there. I saw Godzilla with fucking tuna and kale salad.
Yo, you're the smelly motherfucker eating the tuna.
Yeah, I'm that guy right behind you.
You're the guy that brings the smelly food on the plane.
Yep.
That's all right. But, all right, so when you go to this acting school, how long a program was that? 2 years?
No, the acting school, HB Studios is year round. I mean, you just take classes.
You just take classes.
Yeah, there's no graduation, none of that. You just take classes.
Now, like, when I talk to actors, because it's hard for me. I'm doing a little acting myself on my own show.
You're doing a great job.
Well, thank you.
That's your acting, or is there a script?
Well, there's a script, yeah.
Okay, then you're acting.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely acting. I mean, I know I'm playing myself, but that doesn't mean nothing.
That's kind of hard.
It's really hard.
Because you don't want script supervisor somebody going, I'm not believing you.
Yeah,
I'm playing myself.
I'm not buying it. You gotta sell it, man.
Yeah.
Well, figuring out acting is acting. I can't just be myself. Like, you can't. Well, no, that's not true.
No, you can. You just gotta do it five times.
Right.
You gotta do it for the close up, the wide shot, the over the shoulder shot. You just gotta do it a lot more.
That's right. But
be repetitive, so you get a little
and not be aware of it.
Yeah, and not be aware of the camera right in front of you.
Right. I think that's weirdly the trickiest thing. I think that's something either you have or you don't have. If you're not able to focus in on what's going on with all that bullshit going on around you, if you just can't do that, you're fucking out.
You're fucking. You know what? You're fucking out, but not over. I will say this, I'm still learning, and I find it harder. I'm still learning how to cope with that medium. I like theater.
You do?
I love theater. Cause theater, it's all in. I know the whole script in my head. I did the muscle memory. I did the crazy, a lot more rehearsals, but it's in there. And once you step on stage,
it goes.
You're telling a story, and nobody can stop you.
That's right. There's no
cut. There's no nothing. You're either going to fuck up, or you're going to do it great, and then afterwards, you're going to have a drink and be told off, like, what the fuck was that line? Like, whatever it is, it's spiritually satisfying. In television, back then, we have a joke. Like, we didn't look at TV or movie actors as actors. We're like, what the fuck? You need a close-up?
So your real thing was theater initially?
My real thing was theater, and still is. I still love that medium more. For the art, for the craft.
But so, okay, let's go back a minute. So you're taking these classes.
Yeah.
And what I was going to say is that what was the most important lesson that you learned initially that was the first mind blower? Like, you knew you wanted to be an actor and you liked being on stage, but what was the first tool that,
the first tool that blew my mind, because I talk a good talk. And again, let's be clear. I said acting because I didn't want to be asked questions about what kind of career I wanted.
Right.
So I wanted to act, but it was also a scapegoat. What blew my mind when I started going to classes was the people telling me that I was good.
Right.
That I had something that they would always tell me that you can't teach, which is presence.
Yeah.
that they just, I have to look at you.
Yeah.
I gotta see what you're doing.
Right.
And that all of a sudden hits you with a responsibility.
Right.
All of a sudden you have no escape of I'm really
good. Looking at me.
Yeah, I'm really good. Like I have no reason to fail but myself. Oh, that's fucking great.
Yeah. Because
you're waiting for somebody to say, nah, you're too short. Yeah. Or you're too this or you're too that.
Right. You need work on this.
Yeah, you know.
But you can just show up and people are looking at
you. People are looking at me. And that was kind of cool and kind of scary.
Yeah.
But then after that, just the hardest part, and I tell people when they ask me, when I'm talking to younger cats, just that that perseverance, acting in New York and doing the theater and all that. Yo, there's no money, there's nothing, and you know, being in your 20s with no money, but being an actor or an artist,
right?
You know, it takes that. It, some people call it crazy,
right?
Some people call it passion,
right?
But it's a mind fuck.
Yeah, because it's not like it does. You can be great and not necessarily rewarded with money.
Yeah, you can pay no bills.
Right.
Eat out the fucking trash or, you know, working on the subway and putting the hat down.
That's right. It's not necessarily a meritocracy. It's not like you get so good that you're like, all right, you're ready.
Yeah.
It's still a roll of the fucking dice.
That's right.
And there's still a luck component, a timing component. You know, no matter if you're a genius.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
And that's tricky.
So that stuck to me where I'm like, you know what? Once you're all in, you know, my lady that I was with at the time, who was my wife now, you know, at one point she asked me, you know, like, how long are you going to do this acting? Because you could be broke. Like, how long? And I had to really look at her like, that's a legitimate question, baby.
Yeah.
Like, get off me. It's a legitimate question, baby. Yeah. But here's the real question. It's not how long I'm going to be an actor, because that's it. I'm all in.
Yeah.
I can make it or not, but I love this feeling. Is how long do you want to be fucking with an actor? That's the question you have to ask yourself.
Yeah.
Now, and if you say, you know, I'm in, cool. If you say no, I understand. I'm going to be mad. I'm going to be hurt.
Yeah.
But I'm going to move on.
Right.
And I don't want to, but it's a question you ask yourself.
But you turned it on her, which is interesting. Because
what
you were saying is like, I love you, but this is more important than you.
Well, not more important, but this is what I choose to do.
Okay.
And I guess, you know, and this is where you have relationships issues, where you think about, like, you're asking somebody, look, come along on my dream. I don't know what you're doing right now. I don't know what you want to be. But if you're hanging with me, I want to be an actor.
Yeah.
And those days, she would come home, and I'm on the PlayStation, like, yo, what's up, baby? Yo, what's for lunch? Listen, I sold the Mary J. Blige CD. I got rid of that so we can get this fucking pizza for the, you know, the guys came over, you know. And she would be like, this mother, you know, what the fuck is going on?
Thank God you made it, because
yeah, thank God.
If you start to lose your faith in your desired profession,
that's right.
Then you're going to have to answer to her for the rest of your
life. When I answer her, because she'd be gone.
Maybe. Or she would be like, I'm done with this shit. Yeah. And clearly you don't have it.
That's
so
right.
You better go find something to do.
That's right. So I wouldn't have to answer to her. I'd be gone. I'd be like this. I'd be sitting there like Steve Martin the Jerk in the box. Like, yo, what do I have? Yeah.
So but, the theater thing, though, that's interesting to me. But in terms of outside of just putting your going all in,
yeah.
Did you have to learn how to listen? Did you have to learn,
yes,
like, you know, what were the exercises that you went through? Because you're a natural performer. I mean, I've talked to a lot of actors, and you're a lot more lively on the inside than some of them.
Right. they took a lot of punishment. They look at the closed doors and the IMDb fucking chart punishes a lot of actors, but they get dead inside.
No, I don't know. I think sometimes they're
or they're reserved, or they have to save it.
They're empty vessels. A lot of times it's not even a negative thing, but I think there are some people that are great actors that are not complicated.
That's
they don't
right,
have a lot of
right,
mess going on
right,
upstairs. That's, and I'm not saying you have a lot of mess.
I don't know what a compliment is right now.
It's coming.
All right, good.
You are an authentic character yourself.
Yes. Okay.
So what you're going to bring to a role is going to be some version of this fire that
that's
you got
right,
inside.
Which is good and bad.
Yeah.
It's good and bad.
Sure.
You know, it limits you know, the roles. But you had to relearn how to be organically present.
Mm-hmm.
And would say, like, yes, you had to learn how to listen. Not be there like, I know what I'm gonna do.
It's coming.
Hurry up with your line. Hurry up. I'm gonna say this line this way, and it's gonna be magic. I don't even care about the character. So the character's supposed to be this way. I'm gonna say it this way. You know, you had to learn how to implement who you are without it taking away from who you're playing.
Right.
And yeah.
And also taking away from necessarily the show itself.
The story.
Yeah. I mean, because like a ham's a ham.
A ham's a ham. Well, you know what? On theater, I love it. On the movie game, they can get rid of that ham. Couple of cuts, and all of a sudden, the ham is gone, whether you know it or not.
That's right.
I look at a movie like this. Yo, I have four more scenes. What the fuck happened? What happened to my scene?
What happened to the good one?
Yeah.
This is the only one they got.
That's another thing about the the process in film and television that blew me away, to realize that it's not in your control. Once you put it in the can, your job is done, but your job is
all they
really
care about
done.
Is coverage.
Yes.
And then they're like, they want to have a lot to work with in the editing room.
That's right.
You're better off on an indie film where it's like, we only got three
days.
Got
two. You got two takes, and I'll save one. Second time, you know. And then you know, it was strangely enough, you know, you do, you know, in the film and TV world, I would do a scene, or I'll do a monologue or a moment beautifully. People crying, and then somebody come up like, yeah, but your collar's inside out.
Oh,
you have the drink in the wrong hand.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That would drive me crazy.
Yeah, script supervisor will fuck you.
Fuck you all up. And then I realized, you know, the way we used to laugh at back in the day, where we used to laugh at movie and TV actors like, y'all aren't real.
Yeah.
We had to give them a lot more compliment, because again, like you said, you got to do it five times.
Professional.
And you got to do it, you know, and it might not be about you. You might have just, that whole scene might be fucked up.
Yeah.
Because Prop forgot to put the hammer back on the desk. You know, you're just like, what the fuck? It's my world. You know, so.
But when you did theater, what were some of the roles that, like, you know, where did you do Broadway?
Never got to Broadway. When I started doing theater, Broadway was all singing and dancing and cats, and I wasn't.
No, you never done any of that?
I never did any of that. I did like Broadway for the 24-hour plays. They have these little celebrity 24-hour plays at the American Airlines Theater on Broadway, but never got to Broadway.
But what were some of the roles that you played off Broadway that you were like, this is the shit? I mean, were you ever cast completely against type, where it was so challenging that you had to shut down?
I guess, I played, it's one thing called Happy Pills, where I played this real bipolar, mentally disturbed, depressed, suicidal man who had to, you know, find himself before he, you know, killed himself. And, you know, shit like that, again, on stage with no music and no close-up, and you just really had to implement, you know, your thought process and get it out there. It was challenging. The experience was always something phenomenal and something like life altering, because you was doing it like 7 days a week, and trying to keep it fresh and new every time, presented its own challenges, and it was amazing. It was amazing, and then she got pregnant, and I was like, okay, I gotta pay a bill, Let's go to film and television right away. My picture, my photograph in the cleaners doesn't mean shit. I need it real.
How many kids you got?
I got one. Uh-huh. One daughter.
Is that it?
That's gonna be it. I think so, man. It's hard.
You grew up only child.
I grew up an only child, so I don't know what nobody knows what we're missing. We're just living it. It's our world.
Yeah.
But this is probably, you know, it's the hardest challenge. And then looking at it every once in a while when you're having a Jack and Coke, you're like, this is the most important thing in the world. Like this.
What,
this
the
is,
Jack and Coke?
Well, yes, at that time, yes. But just having a kid, having a child, all of a sudden you have this thing that you are creating and you are in charge of, and you are implementing everything that you think you know.
Right.
And trying to create a being, or help, you know, establish a being to go on and live. And it's daunting. It's daunting. It's scary. And, you know, and right now my daughter's 16, and I've always heard parents talk about, you know, 16 is a hard age, and I'm getting a lot of feedback from my daughter, a lot of shit talking and everything. But I think what's scaring me the most is I feel like I'm running out of time. You know, and that's what parents look at. They look at that kid like the mirror, like, oh shit, she's sick. Did I teach her everything?
Yeah.
Does she know everything, or did I just fuck this up?
How old is she now?
16.
Oh,
I'm running out of time. She only got like 2 years left.
No, you're out of time.
I'm done. Don't say that. Fuck. Okay, then I might have another kid. It's when you look at her like this. Okay, now that I know what not to do, let me get another shot at this.
No, she's 16. It's all the wiring has been put in.
Oh man,
you're gonna have to hope for the best now.
I gotta hope.
And when she makes mistakes, you got to be there to go like, it's okay.
It's
baby.
It's my fault. At the end of the day, it's my fault. And there's one asshole guy like, I'll rewire her, Dad. That's what I gotta look forward to now. The hot wire dude.
Well, I mean, you know, being a hot wire dude, or having been that yourself.
Yes.
You know they're gonna
sins
come.
Of the fathers. How about you? Any kids?
No.
Did you that on purpose? Did you like pull out like national? Well,
I am a big puller outer, but I had I was married twice. I didn't have kids. It was not a priority for me somehow.
Okay.
I guess I'm just too selfish, or I didn't think I could handle it.
You start shaking while you're talking. Like,
I know, man. It's like there's part of me that thinks like I should have done it, but I think that, you know, things happen for a reason.
That's right.
I'm a very anxious guy.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm a very panicky guy. Things get a little out of hand for me pretty quickly. So.
I think you should be honored. There was one comedian that I heard, Dove, his name was Dove something. I don't know.
Davidoff.
Dove Davidoff.
Yeah,
he had a what do you call it?
Remind me of him.
What do you call that thing when you go up there? A set. He had a set. Yeah. And he said, you know, National Pullout Day. Those guys should be those guys who know that they're not ready for parenthood and they pull out. They should be rewarded too. They should be celebrated because they're our own heroes. Yeah. Are not having too many asshole kids running around.
That's right.
And so I celebrate you, sir.
Well,
there should be a date.
Thank you very much.
Maybe this date is the date.
Every day is our day. That's when we talk to you guys. We're going, I hope I did it right.
I hope I did it. I pulled out, yes. So, it's, one kid is cool. I'm having a good time with her. I'm learning a lot. Hopefully, I'm teaching a lot. And it's fun to watch her and see.
And she's a good kid.
Yeah. I think, you know, these kids, they seem different. These kids seem like a lot more connected to who they are,
yeah,
and what their worth is,
right?
You know, I've seen so many.
They're less like caring. They seem a little more free. They're more well adjusted.
Yeah, either that or they're twisted geniuses where they say, you know what, I'm not built for that world. So I'm going to create this new world where I don't got to talk to nobody. I can just tweet them. I can just Instagram. I can create.
Just text.
I can create different characters for different people.
Yeah.
And well, I think that's what they're doing. They're building this world where they say, you know what? Looks like you guys, with all your interaction, you're telling us we should do this, this, and this. You got the world fucked up.
Yeah.
It's not like all your actions got this world in a great place.
Right.
So how about we do this? We're going to make it different. And we're going to, and if you don't get it, you don't get it. But it's a more, what do you call it, social media.
Yeah.
It's a whole new thing.
They're more connected, but less connected.
Exactly.
It's weird.
And it might be a good thing. It might save the planet.
We'll see. I don't know. I have no idea. Yeah, old ways die hard. You know?
They do die hard. Yes. Yeah.
So, all right. So you did a lot of television. I mean, when you started, when you decided you were going to do television, you did television.
I did
a lot of New York television. You did Law and Order.
Every Law and Order. That saved every black actor. Law and Order was the staple to every black actor. That was the first time I did the Rat Frank. Like, I know who did it.
Yeah.
And they love the way I point it. And it was like this. All right, Law and Order, Law and Order SVU, Law and Order Criminal Intent. And it's the same character. Same character, different orange jumpsuit. I know who did it. No, that dude right there. I got you. Yo, all of them. And New York Undercover.
Yeah.
And I did that. My first TV job was Law and Order, where this black dude that was a cop was going to the HB studios and got me a job. I was an extra in the courtroom. And I knew I was going to be a big, big, big star because I was the extra in the courtroom. And when they said, you know, he's guilty, I was like, well, I'm not. Well, everybody's just doing the same. I jumped up, oh my God, got, and walked out. And the director was like, cut, what are you doing? And I was like, well, shouldn't somebody be mad at it? Like, I'm just macting. And they're like, okay, go back in the holding. You, go back in the holding. But the guy, I forgot the actor's name, the black dude who got me a job, I told him, and he was like this, he did the right thing. He did. Fuck, don't be an extra no more. Don't be an extra no more. No, no, nothing wrong with it, but it doesn't suit you.
Yeah.
And I realized, oh, okay, that's right. I need bigger, man. I need to talk. And, you know, then after that, it was like, I think my Law and Order again, because they would recycle us.
Yeah.
You know, and they would just, one day I was, you know, perp number one, and the next day I was.
But did you have the same sort of aggravation that some other black actors have? It's like, how do I get out of this?
Not at that time.
Yeah.
No, because, you know, I say now, you know, I was more stereotyped as unemployed than I was as convict number two.
Right.
So convict number two was okay.
Right.
Only after like about a year and a half did you go like this. Okay, I don't want to be in jail no more. I don't want to go to jail. I don't want to come out of jail. And I don't want to be in jail already. Give me something else. And they were like, no. like, no. You know, I didn't realize that, you know, a lot of actors out there who are doing theater and doing off-Broadway, just understand there's a certain freedom to that because your money is coming from another place.
Yeah.
So that you can say, I'm not doing that part. Right. I'll do that part. Yeah. Oh, I'll do this.
Yeah.
Because you didn't care.
Right.
But once you start paying bills with acting,
yeah,
you say no until you have to say yes. You say no until your daughter's like, Dad, my shoes are too tight.
And also a casting director going, he's difficult.
He's difficult. Yeah. Yeah. Or he say no. Okay. Yeah, you say no three times. And he'll say, you're right. Next.
Yeah. Don't even call him.
Yeah.
He's got
Where's Nick Cannon? Where's Lemon State? Next. Come on. Move on. You know, and so, and you get to a point where, of course, you say, because like, I want to do something that, like The Wire, I love the fact that people really embrace this
show. Well,
that
was a career-changing turn for you.
Everything.
I mean, like, once I locked into that thing,
yeah,
because I came to it later. Mm-hmm. I didn't watch it when it was on. It required too much attention.
Yeah.
When it
yeah.
was on, it's like you miss one episode. And I'm like,
where are we? What's going on? Yeah, my subtitle thing is not working. I don't understand what these fucking black people are saying. I need a subtitle.
Well, it wasn't that. It was just that you really had to start at the beginning a book.
That's right. Yeah.
And I sat there for like 2 weeks and I watched the entire fucking thing. Mm-hmm. Like I got it all.
Yeah,
rented
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. The character of Bubbles is really the only fucking character in the entire city that changes for the better. That like you know, the only guy that you know at the end of everything, after all is said and done, you're like, that guy, he's all right.
That guy,
he made it.
Look, he's having dinner with his sister.
He right?
Made, yeah, yeah.
But like, I don't remember any other characters, you know, evolving to it. Like, maybe I'm wrong. I'm trying to remember, but your character, you know, from where you were at the beginning,
this
spineless junkie.
Well, we're never spineless. I don't know if spineless is the
well. You need the dope, so you know you did what you had to do.
Yeah. It takes a lot of courage. Nah.
But your character is really the way they closed the series in my memory.
Yeah.
Was that you know that the one guy that was sort of pivotal in all this stuff and sort of the eyes of the world on some level, mm-hmm. who was really the most tragic character in some ways personally,
mm-hmm. yeah.
was able to transcend that. It was emotionally devastating.
Well, again. What was great about David Simon and the creators of the show and just the audience being drawn into the show and these characters. What's great about hearing you say that is our expectation. Because if you look at it, you just said, you know, my character seems to have gotten, you know, was the arc and gotten better. Only because of everything that I've been through, that character's been through, the way David Simon ended it was, you didn't see me as president, you didn't see me having a fucking CEO job.
Right.
You saw me go upstairs and have a dinner with my sister.
I'm getting choked up thinking about
right?
it. Yeah.
That's small.
She wouldn't let you in the house.
She wouldn't let me in. And all she did was open that door. And since that reward was so little but poignant, it made it feel like Bubbles has changed. Like, we don't know. Season 6, I'll probably be a junkie again.
Sure.
Who knows?
Yeah.
But just seeing that small step, I think we all look at people and ourselves as, you know, we haven't made it or we're not successful unless we have this big thing.
Right.
But it's these little victories that are important to embrace, you know?
Yeah.
Like, connecting it to my daughter, you know, you try so hard for perfection that you forget to enjoy the good.
Yeah.
You know? You forget to enjoy the excellence.
You're always thinking about more.
You could have did better. You could have did better.
Yeah, yeah.
You got 99?
Yeah.
What the fuck? Were you sleeping on that one? Did you go back and double check? You're just so happy you finished the test, you just handed it in, right?
At 99?
No double check. Come on. You know, so yeah. So, it was a great experience. And even now, it's still a great experience because a lot of people got to it late. And we, you know, just the DVD and the on-demand really has...
changes everything.
Yeah, has people come up to me now or different countries or whatever saying, hey, Bubs, blah, blah, blah. Third season of The Wire, I had a meltdown. Third season, I was like, oh, my God, if I got to get high or if I got to be sleeping in the row house again, if I got... The junkie thing got to me.
And then why? Because it was just exhausting?
Exhausting. It's not a great headspace. You know, if you're acting and this is a thing that you know is a career changer. Like, I felt the weight of, this is the first time I've been a character and people, you know, it means depth something with death. I stayed in. I did that Daniel Day-Lewis shit, like, to a stint. I didn't go Heath Ledger.
Yeah.
But I was in character. And I was in the one-bedroom apartment with a mattress.
Yeah.
You know, laying around trying to, you know, stay connected to that lifestyle. And all the rest of my castmates are hanging out, partying, drinking champagne.
Yeah.
And being drug dealers and having a lot of, you know.
Yeah.
But it was hard, and then you start to fear, you know, is this the box I'm putting myself into, you know, for black
career wise,
yeah, for black actors, you know, a junkie or playing a you know a homosexual, they were like career, you know, death,
right,
you're not gonna work again,
right,
and you start thinking about that like, oh my God, what am I doing,
yeah,
so I had a meltdown, and you know, there's certain actors like Sam Jackson who just came in and embraced me and was like, yo, shut the fuck up.
Like, what, during your meltdown?
Yeah. Like,
Where did he come in?
Well, you know, off, like, you know, when you're not shooting.
Yeah.
You know, I would go to different, you know, hang out.
You were hanging out with him?
Yeah, I bumped into him, and he, like, one of our directors, Clark Johnson, was directing SWAT.
Uh-huh.
And was like, yo, why don't you come to L.A.? Come hang out. I came to set, and Sam Jackson was like, first time I, you know, really met him, he was like, gave me a hug and was like, yo, you're doing a great job. And I'm talking to Sam Jackson. Yeah. You know, and he said, I'm doing a great job. I know his past.
Yeah.
If I convinced him, this is fucking Gator. If I convinced him, this is great. And, you know, I got a chance to feel, you know, he had that kind of personality where you felt like you can talk to him.
Well, what'd you say to him?
I just said, yo, man, this... What do I do after this? Like this, you know, this heroin addict, and I feel like I'm in a box. Like people only see me this one way.
Yeah.
And he was like, wait. So you're complaining because they know your name and they know your character? Like I've been in 100 movies with people that they don't know who they are. They've been in 100. You know, you shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
You have an iconic character that people will always remember you by because of what you did and how you played it. You can't complain. All you can do is you keep doing what you do. And every character you get, whether it's the same or not, you bring your A game, and sooner or later, it'll change. Yeah. But other than that, shut the fuck up. And I was like, well, all right, well, give me Tarantino's number and hook me up, motherfucker.
Yeah. But well, he seems like he'll do just about anything now.
He's a cool, anything is better than what he used to do.
That's right.
So, he will stay working.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so, that's important.
That's important. And it just
so what happened on the show, though? So you have this meltdown. Did you approach the creators and say, like, you know, what is this?
No. I never approached the, you know, you never approached the money. I wasn't that crazy. I didn't have that much of a meltdown. I didn't like flip out on the set. I just had like a little depression, you know, anxiety and depression, and just talked to other actors.
But this is before you knew how that character would turn out.
Yes. And then when it found out, again, another crazy, like almost just weird sabotage or whatever, or authenticity. I don't even know the right word for it. But towards the fifth season, you know, I had to sit down with the creator of the show because I felt the real Bubbles passed away. It was Will Bubbs. He was a informant for one of the creators of the show, Ed Burns, who was a cop. And Bubbles passed away of AIDS. And when I found out that I might live, I felt like it was unfair. Mm-hmm. I was like, our show is known for being great, for being authentic, being real. And we're playing these real characters. I don't feel this. I think it's a little unfair that my character lived. Now, I don't want to cut my money, but at that time, I'm like, you know what? Is this right? Are we doing the right thing?
Yeah.
David Simon's great. David Simon was like, you know, at the end of the day, I've just dragged these people out of the audience to look at a piece of our world with this dark, depressed, nothing's ever going to change mentality.
Yeah.
Motherfuckers got to get out of the bed. There's got to be some sort of hope. There's got to be some glimpse. And it's all we need as people.
And you're it.
And Bubbs was it. And Bubbs was the one that said, you know what? Let him go have a wing dinner with his fucking sister. Let him go eat.
That's hope enough.
That's hope enough. And you said it, right? For you, it was like, oh, my God, look at Bubbs. He's on the stairs.
Yeah.
And, you know, but there was moments where I felt that was unfair. There was moments where I felt like...
To the memory of the real guy?
Yes, to the memory of the real guy. Because his shooting in Baltimore was so phenomenal. And, you know, I'm chasing the dragon now when you're looking for different shows. There's never going to be, so far there's never been a show or an experience doing a show when everything was just so incredible. Like the actors, there was no ego. Everybody was like, hey, I know you. I kind of know you. Like everybody was starting. It was like everybody's brand new start. That never really happens on TV. There's got to be a star first.
Right.
But everybody's brand new. Then you're in Baltimore on location. Like, there was no sets.
Yeah.
You know, they rip open the row house and like, okay, clean it up a little bit. All right, fuck it, Bubs. Just go in. You know, I did one scene where
filth.
Yeah. One scene where I'm crawling on a roof and I got stuck with a needle because it's there.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, shit. Oh, can you finish the scene? We got medic right there. Just finish the scene. I'm like, oh, shit. Like,
and then you
got
to go get an AIDS test.
Then you got to get shot and all that stuff. And then, you know, David Simon was smart where, you know, whoever you were doing a scene with, there were real-life personas around you. Like, if I'm doing a scene where I'm doing something, there's a real recovered or junkie around.
Yeah.
Or when you're a gangbanger, there's a real gangbanger playing,
you got Steve Earle. He's a real recovered junkie.
Real dude.
Yeah.
Funny about him. That kept accountability was I didn't know who he was
right?
And I go to I'm having a good time like oh, I'm killing it boy who's my scene partner today who am I working with and they point out Steve Earle and I'm like this who the fuck is that like that dude. I don't want my scene fucked up. Like, I want my scene to work. And we do a blocking rehearsal, and he couldn't walk and say his line.
Yeah.
Like, he would stop and forget. Yeah. And I'm like this. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I got to carry this fucking scene.
Yeah.
And David Simon was like, do you know who that is? I'm like, nah. Yeah, I know he's a guy who don't know how to fucking say his line. That's what I know. And he's like, okay. And he bought, he had somebody bring over all of a sudden a box full of CDs. Yeah. I didn't know he had about 40 CDs.
Oh, yeah,
he's
yeah.
like the Bob Dylan
yeah,
of
yeah.
someone. And I'm like, this is that dude? And I'm playing it, I'm listening, I'm like, oh my God. So I go to him now, I'm like this, how am I doing? Am I doing okay? Do you believe me, Bubs? Did I do too much shaking here? Like, he's a great dude.
Yeah, he is.
And it was beautiful. It was beautiful.
I can't imagine the two of you together because he's a talker.
We had a good time.
Yeah.
We had a good time like this. Cut. You want to say the lines now, guys? Yeah. Can we get up? Yeah. And I went to a couple of his concerts. He's a great dude, man.
He is a good dude. So now, after you do The Wire, like, it's weird because when I saw you at the Independent Spirit Awards, I'm like, that's the fucking dude. And so I don't do that too often, but it did happen on the subway in New York with another dude. You know, the dude who played the guy who opened the gym?
Cuddy.
I saw him on the subway, and I'm like, oh, fuck, that's that guy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I got to say something. And I was like, no, don't bother me. And I'm like, no, I mean, it's going to feel good.
Yes, and that's one thing I love. That we, you know, as actors or people in the business,
performer.
You're waiting for somebody to walk up to you like
this. You
do. Yeah, dickhead. You ain't all that. What the fuck? What are you doing now, homie? Like, but our audience, the Y audience, it feels like it's they love coming up.
I was like, you were great. Yeah. He seemed to really appreciate it. He's a good cat.
Of course, we love it. We understand, you know, that our show meant something. You know,
right?
And in the middle of it, while we were shooting, nobody was really watching, so we never knew. Nobody was really watching. And then every award season, we're like this. Really? Boston Legal? Really? Yeah, we can't get a fucking slot?
Yeah.
Can we not? We couldn't even go have a free champagne and get a fucking swag bag. That's all we wanted. We didn't want to win. We just wanted to get a swag bag. We were giving out fucking CDs and iPods.
Yeah.
People will come up to us and really celebrate their experience in watching the show.
Now, how, in the long run here, how your parents feel about your stuff?
My parents, you know, parents are great. My mom was mad when, she's so funny because she was happy I booked the job. Right? Yeah. She's like, oh, finally, my son, you know, because they get a sense of relief that their son's going to be okay.
Right. It's really a fear of security.
Yes, right. Yeah. And now, you got a job. I'm playing a junkie. What? They said that I didn't look like Bubs, but I had the essence. And it was, she was like, are they insulting me? My son does not have the essence of a fucking heroin addict. I'm like, nah, mom, it's acting, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, she was great, and she's always shocked. Like, we went, you know, Barack Obama, I met him at a Prague, and he was like, what's up, Bubs? And my mom was like, oh, my God. Bubs, the president knows you, you know. And she, you know, she was, it's great. It's great, and she was, you know, very happy to see that, you know, I did something or I was part of something that means so much to other people. And then at the same time, like we were talking about before, we get crazy sidetracked, is that, am I going through a certain thing right now where, you know, I'm known as this dude and it's hard to see me in a love scene
right
now. Somebody going, hey, look at Bubs getting some ass, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, every time I pop up on screen, it's a blessing and a curse where people will go, there go Bubs.
Yeah.
And you want to be able to, you know, give respect to somebody else who's casting you and not distract from their story and be, you know, looked at as a different character.
Right.
And it's harder when you're known or you do a character so well.
Yeah.
To do, you know.
But also just getting out of that the world of I mean, not only Bubs, but, you know, the world
the whole
of Perps.
Thing. That's right. The whole thing. You know, going to jail, coming out of jail, being in jail.
Yeah.
Like,
but you know, you're an attractive guy.
I think so.
Yeah. So what has been going on out here
you know, and it takes a long time. And again, you say yes, you say no until you have to. But now I just booked I just shot a pilot with Ron Perlman called A Hand of God, Amazon, which is another thing for actors that is great.
It's breaking
so
up.
There's so many ways. So A Hand of God, Amazon, it's an Amazon series. I play the mayor. I play Ron Perlman's best friend, and I play the mayor. I got a little corrupt tendencies. They guarantee me I'm not going to be smoking crack like Marion Barry by season 3. That's not going to happen. But it's a different look. It's a different feel. The movie The Spectacular Now.
Oh yeah, that got really good.
It was a genre changer.
Yeah, it was at Sundance. I didn't see it. It was really great.
Really, really good. Another movie that we grew up in the world of The Breakfast Club and Say Anything and Fast Time at Ridgemont High. You can't really mess with this genre. It's been done a billion times.
Yeah.
How do you make it new? And Spectacular Now kind of made it new and relevant to these kids and really kind of great. And I play a teacher.
Okay.
And only because one of the producers, and this always happens now, which is a good thing, it's getting better, is that somebody will see a character and go, hey, you know, what about the Bubs? And then at first they laugh. What, the junkie? Come on. No, I love him. And then they go like this. Wait, I do love him. Hey, maybe. Let's see him. And then when I go in, they go, oh, see, you don't look like, you're not, you know, you're not real drunk.
You
like,
got nice clothes on. Yeah. You got your foreshines on again.
You know, after the first season.
Yeah.
You know, I would go to HBO parties, which is great, and or the HBO fights.
Sure.
They allow you to go and all that stuff. And, you know, Mark Wahlberg was the first celebrity that I remember that came up to me and was dead like, and Mark is kind of an intense dude.
He is,
cool as hell, intense.
Yeah.
But they had me at the crab, at the buffet table eating. Yeah. Like, yo, you got a good job now. Yo, clean up your act. Don't go back. You're really good at what you do. So, yo, this is a different moment. I'm like, yo, what are you thinking, man? He's like, you're not a junkie? I'm like, no, I'm not a fucker. I'm an actor. I grew up in New York. And he's like, oh, man, yo, I swear to God, I thought they grabbed you off the street of Baltimore. I'm like, nah, motherfucker, no. But, you know, people really thought.
Did he think that, did then he say, like, you're even better than I thought you were?
He was like, yo, just don't go. I don't know. I don't know how you're doing it. If you're taking a little hit, I don't know. But, you know, people, and again, that's a compliment.
It's an amazing compliment.
Yeah, I think it's phenomenal. But you got to make sure that the studios don't think that I'm a fucking insurance risk.
Right. Well, that's the interesting thing about, it always baffles me, too, about the media landscape now, is that people, a lot, even intelligent people, cannot tell the difference between reality and fiction. Like, there's this weird gray area where something is so gritty or so real, they, like, assume, like, just because of the way everything works now, like, that guy's got to be a real guy. What the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah. Again, movie magic, medium. You know, I'm in everybody's living room every Sunday, right? And people will come up to me, like, I'm on a train. Like, either they think I'm a real character or they think I'm, like, if I ride the train in New York, you know, I fall asleep. It's a long ass ride.
Yo, he's high.
People are like, yo, he's high or, yo, what you do? Where's your money?
Yeah.
What happened to you? Yeah. Why are you riding the train? I'm like, it's the fastest way in the city to get around. No, come on, man. You ain't got the Lamborghini. No, I don't know what it's HBO. It's not network.
But it's quite crazy. I don't know why the fuck people don't. I can't stand people that don't take the train in New York. Can't stand it.
It's like, best. You do feel like cattle. There's certain days.
Who
you
cares? But it's like my manager's like, we're going to take a cab 7 blocks. What are you out of your fucking mind?
That's a beast.
You take, it's ridiculous.
You don't like Uber? You're not an Uber guy?
No, but Uber, I don't care. It's like, I don't want to be stuck in a fucking car in New York City, no matter what.
Well, I will say I got to disagree with you. I like the idea of having the train, but if you ask me, like people ask, do I prefer being stuck? When that fucking train stops, we'll be moving shortly.
I know.
We'll be moving shortly. Yeah. Or stuck in traffic with my fucking driver, my radio and my air conditioning.
I hear you.
I'll take the 405 traffic over stuck in the F train when everything shuts down.
Well, as much as I love the train, is one of the reasons I left. At some point you get tired of having a guy right here.
Just breathing on you.
Yeah, the one guy
with the trench coat like this.
Yeah. Not that guy again.
Oh my God.
Every morning with that guy.
Oh, he's still got a little distance with his shit. Yeah. So, I New York, you just like the opportunity and the advantages of having options.
Yeah.
Especially when you're saying that you don't drink no more and all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, when you get fucked up in L.A., you're in trouble.
Yeah. You better get a car.
You got to get a car, and that's real expensive. from Beverly Hills to Highland Park, now you better have some money.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so.
You're not getting behind the wheel.
You got to
protect yourself.
In New York, you got the train, you got the bus, you got a cab, you got the...
They'll get mad at you.
They'll get mad, you do, you know.
Yeah, so
you
what?
You jump out the yellow cab.
Yeah.
No disrespect, guys, but they didn't want to drop us off, so every once in a while, we'd just be like, yeah, drop me over here.
Well, I'm glad you're doing well, man.
Thank you, man. Thank you very much.
It's an honor talking to you.
I appreciate it. I had a great time.
Wow. Right? What a great guy. What a great conversation. I was buzzed for 3 hours after I talked to him. I hope you enjoyed that. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF pod needs. Get some merch, Christmas presents, whatever you got to do. Enjoy, read the blog, leave a comment. Do what you got to do. Get that app. Listen to Leslie Jones. She's something else, man. Get the free app and upgrade, and you can stream all the stuff. Oh my God, enough plugging. Enough plugging. Right? What are we doing? Is this a tradition now? Yeah. Thank you. I think that was a little indulgent.
Boomer lives.